Chapter 27. Mortification. For she delighted in new words, and quickly found that there was an English key at the end, which would make her very wise about Latin, at slight expense. She presently made up her mind to skip the rules in the syntax. The examples became so absorbing. These mysterious sentences, snatched from an unknown context, like strange horns of beasts, and leaves of unknown plants, brought from some far-off region, gave boundless scope to her imagination, and were all the more fascinating, because they were in a peculiar tongue of their own, which she could learn to interpret. It was really very interesting, the Latin grammar, that Tom had said no girls could learn, and she was proud, because she found it interesting. The most fragmentary examples were her favorites. Moore's omnibus est communis would have been jejune, only she liked to know the Latin, but the fortunate gentleman whom everyone congratulated, because he had a son endowed with such a disposition afforded her a great deal of pleasant conjecture, and she was quite lost in the thick grove penetrable by no star, when Tom called out, "Now then, Maxie, give us the grammar." "Oh, Tom, it's such a pretty book," she said, as she jumped out of the large armchair to give it him. "It's much prettier than the dictionary. I could learn Latin very soon. I don't think it's at all hard." "Oh, I know what you've been doing," said Tom. "You've been reading the English at the end. Any donkey can do that." Tom seized the book, and opened it with a determined and businesslike air, as much as to say that he had a lesson to learn which no donkeys would find themselves equal to. Maggie, rather piqued, turned to the bookcases to amuse herself with puzzling out the titles. Presently Tom called to her, "Colon here, Maxie, come and hear, if I can say this. Stand at that end of the table, where Mr. Stelling sits when he hears me." Maggie obeyed, and took the open book. "Where do you begin, Tom?" "Oh, I begin at appellativa arborum, apostrophe, because I say all over again what I've been learning this week." Tom sailed along pretty well for three lines, and Maggie was beginning to forget her office of prompter in speculating as to what Maz could mean, which came twice over, when he stuck fast at sunt idiom volucrum. "Don't tell me, Maggie, sunt idiom volucrum ad Austria, sedis, no," said Maggie, opening her mouth and shaking her head. "Sunt idiom volucrum," said Tom, very slowly, as if the next words might be expected to come sooner, when he gave them this strong hint that they were waited for. "C-E-U," said Maggie, getting impatient. "Oh, I know, hold your tongue," said Tom. "Su passer, herundo, ferrum ferrum." Tom took his pencil, and made several hard dots with it on his book cover. "Ferrum, oh dear, oh dear. Tom," said Maggie, "what a time you are." At Austria, no, no," said Maggie, "a tigress, oh yes, now I can do," said Tom. "It was tigress, volts, I'd forgotten. A tigress, volutes, apishum." With some further stammering and repetition, Tom got through the next few lines. "Now then," he said, "the next is what I've just learned for tomorrow. Give me hold of the book a minute." After some whispered gabbling, assisted by the beating of his fist on the table, Tom returned the book. "Masculine amina in a," he began. "No, Tom," said Maggie, "that doesn't come next. It's nomen non crescens genitivo, crescens genitivo," exclaimed Tom, with a derisive laugh, for Tom had learned this omitted passage for his yesterday's lesson, and a young gentleman does not require an intimate or extensive acquaintance with Latin before he can feel the pitiable absurdity of a false quantity. "Crescens genitivo. What a little silly you are, Maggie." "Well, you needn't laugh, Tom, for you didn't remember it at all. I'm sure it's spelt so. How was I to know? F-E-E-H. I told you girls couldn't learn Latin. It's nomen non crescens genitivo." "Very well then," said Maggie, pouting. "I can say that as well as you can. And you don't mind your stops. for you ought to stop twice as long at a semicolon as you do at a comma, and you make the longest stops where there ought to be no stop at all. Oh, well, don't chatter. Let me go on. They were presently fetched to spend the rest of the evening in the drawing room, and Maggie became so animated with Mr. Stelling, who, she felt sure, admired her cleverness, that Tom was rather amazed and alarmed at her audacity. But she was suddenly subdued by Mr. Stelling's alluding to a little girl of whom he had heard that she once ran away to the gypsies. What a very odd little girl that must be, said Mrs. Stelling, meaning to be playful, but a playfulness that turned on her supposed oddity was not at all to Maggie's taste. She feared that Mr. Stelling, after all, did not think much of her, and went to bed in rather low spirits. Mrs. Stelling, she felt, looked at her, as if she thought her hair was very ugly, because it hung down straight behind. Nevertheless, it was a very happy fortnight to Maggie, this visit to Tom. She was allowed to be in the study, while he had his lessons, and in her various readings got very deep into the examples in the Latin grammar. The astronomer who hated women generally caused her so much puzzling speculation that she one day asked Mr. Stelling if all astronomers hated women, or whether it was only this particular astronomer. But forestalling his answer, she said, I suppose it's all astronomers. Because, you know, they live up in high towers, and if the women came there they might talk and hinder them from looking at the stars. Mr. Stelling liked her prattle immensely, and they were on the best terms. She told Tom she should like to go to school to Mr. Stelling, as he did, and learn just the same things. She knew she could do Euclid, for as he had looked into it again, and she saw what ABC meant, they were the names of the lines. I'm sure you couldn't do it now, said Tom, and I'll just ask Mr. Stelling if you could. I don't mind, said the little conceited minx, I'll ask him myself. Mr. Stelling, she said, that same evening when they were in the drawing room, couldn't I do Euclid, and all Tom's lessons, if you were to teach me instead of him? No, you couldn't, said Tom, indignantly. Gee, girls can't do Euclid, can they, sir? They can pick up a little of everything, I dare say, said Mr. Stelling. They've a great deal of superficial cleverness, but they couldn't go far into anything. They're quick and shallow. Tom, delighted with this verdict, telegraphed his triumph by wagging his head at Maggie, behind Mr. Stelling's chair. As for Maggie, she had hardly ever been so mortified. As he had been so proud to be called quick all her little life, and now it appeared that this quickness was the brand of inferiority. It would have been better to be slow, like Tom. Ha, ha, Miss Maggie, said Tom, when they were alone, you see it's not such a fine thing to be quick. You'll never go far into anything, you know. And Maggie was so oppressed by this dreadful destiny that as he had no spirit for a retort. But when this small apparatus of shallow quickness was fetched away in the gig by Luke, and the study was once more quite lonely for Tom, he missed her grievously. He had really been brighter, and had got through his lessons better, since as he had been there, and as he had asked Mr. Stelling so many questions about the Roman Empire, and whether there really ever was a man who said, in Latin, I would not buy it for a farthing or a rotten nut, or whether that had only been turned into Latin, that Tom had actually come to a dim understanding of the fact that there had once been people upon the earth who were so fortunate as to know Latin without learning it through the medium of the Eton grammar. This luminous idea was a great addition to his historical acquirements during this half year, which were otherwise confined to an epitomized history of the Jews. But the dreary half year did come to an end. How glad Tom was to see the last yellow leaves fluttering before the cold wind. The dark afternoons and the first December snow seemed to him far livelier than the August sunshine. And that he might make himself the surer about the flight of the days that were carrying him homeward, he stuck 21 sticks deep in a corner of the garden when he was 3 weeks from the holidays, and pulled one up every day with a great wrench, throwing it to a distance with a vigor of will which would have carried it to limbo, if it had been in the nature of sticks to travel so far. But it was worth purchasing, even at the heavy price of the Latin grammar, the happiness of seeing the bright light in the parlor at home, as the gig passed noiselessly over the snow-covered bridge, the happiness of passing from the cold air to the warmth, and the kisses and the smiles of that familiar hearth, where the pattern of the rug, and the grate and the fire irons were erst ideas, that it was no more possible to criticize than the solidity and extension of matter. There is no sense of ease like the ease we felt in those scenes where we were born, where objects became dear to us, before we had known the labor of choice, and where the outer world seemed only an extension of our own personality. We accepted and loved it as we accepted our own sense of existence and our own limbs. Very commonplace, even ugly, that furniture of our early home might look if it were put up to auction. An improved taste in upholstery scorns it, and is not the striving after something better and better in our surroundings the grand characteristic that distinguishes man from the brute, or, to satisfy a scrupulous accuracy of definition, that distinguishes the British man from the foreign brute. But heaven knows where that striving might lead us, if our affections had not a trick of twining round those old inferior things. If the loves and sanctities of our life had no deep immovable roots in memory, one's delight in an elderberry bush overhanging the confused leafage of a hedgerow bank is a more gladdening sight than the finest cistus or fuchsia spreading itself on the softest undulating turf, is an entirely unjustifiable preference to a nursery gardener, or to any of those regulated minds who are free from the weakness of any attachment that does not rest on the demonstrable superiority of qualities. And there is no better reason for preferring this elderberry bush than that it stirs an early memory, that it is no novelty in my life, speaking to me merely through my present sensibilities to form and color, but the long companion of my existence, that wove itself into my joys when joys were vivid. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.